Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's promise to look into a report on his nominee for drug czar after a Washington Post 60 Minutes expose revealed that Congressman Tom Marino pushed legislation that hobbled the DEA in combating the opioid crisis by preventing their enforcement efforts against big drug companies and distributors who manufacture and peddle OxyContin and other drugs that have killed close to 200,000 Americans. The editor of the Journal of Drug Policy Analysis, Mark Kleinman, a professor of public policy in the Crime and Justice Program at the Marin Institute for Urban Management at New York University, and author of When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, joins us to discuss the legislation championed by Marino and Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn, who received $200,000 in campaign contribution from pharmaceutical companies that prevented the DEA from seizing suspicious shipments of pills to rogue pharmacies and corrupt doctors. We'll also assess what President Trump might offer in terms of solutions when next week he is expected to declare the opioid epidemic a national emergency. Then we'll get an analysis of the results of the Austrian elections, which indicate a major shift to the right inflamed by an Islamophobic and anti-immigrant campaign by the handsome 31-year-old Sebastian Kurz, the leader of the People's Party, which captured 31% of the vote and is likely to form a coalition with the right-wing Freedom Party, founded by former Nazis. Christian Schuller, senior editor of the magazine and documentary department of the Austrian TV network ORF, joins us to discuss the rise of anti-immigrant populism and nationalism across Western and Eastern Europe. Then finally, we'll examine the fate of the Kurds in northern Iraq, who are surrounded by enemies, Turkey, Iran, and now the government in Baghdad, which just seized oil-rich Kirkuk, the cash cow of Iraqi Kurdistan. Henri Baki, a professor of international relations at Lehigh University, who was a member of the State Department's policy planning staff, joins us to discuss how a more engaged U.S. president and State Department might have prevented the Kurds from going ahead with a referendum on independence, which has backfired, spreading more instability and possibly provoking conflict across the region. And joining us now is Mark Kleinman, who's a professor of public policy in the Crime and Justice Program at the Marin Institute on Urban Management at New York University. He's the author of When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, and he edits the Journal of Drug Policy Analysis, and he also worked for the U.S. Department of Justice as Director of Policy and Management Analysis for the Criminal Division. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Kleinman.
Thank you, Ian.
So, Mark, today the president, I think, was a little bit embarrassed in an impromptu press conference he had in the Rose Garden, where he was asked about his choice of Representative Tom Marino, Republican of Pennsylvania, to be his drug czar, nominated by Trump to lead up the Office of National Drug Policy. He, along with Marsha Blackburn, co-sponsored a bill that 60 Minutes and the Washington Post did an investigation on, and it is pretty clear that that bill that they got passed, while maybe a lot of the people who voted for it, including the person who signed it, President Obama, may not have known what was in it, the results have been pretty clear. It has really hampered the DEA from interdicting a lot of OxyContin and similar drugs in terms of massive shipments to suspicious pharmacies, rogue pharmacies, and corrupt doctors around the United States. There hasn't been a DEA suspension order against these shipments for the last 2 years, and this has helped fuel the opioid crisis that has killed over 200,000 Americans.
That's the story as it appeared in the Washington Post, and it has elements of truth to it. I'm amused to watch the sponsors of the bill scurry away from it. Marsha Blackburn apparently has expressed shock that anybody did what she did and thinks that it needs to be revisited. And of course, Donald Trump demonstrating his usual loyalty to his subordinates. And he picked somebody whose signature accomplishment this bill was as drug czar, and as soon as criticism had appeared, he said, well, I'm going to have to look into him. The background is complicated. Historically, major drug companies and major pharmacy benefit managers, drug distributors, were massively oversupplying prescription painkillers, especially to Appalachia and to parts of Florida. If you just looked at the map, it looked like those places must have enormous pain problems because they just stood out for how much oxycodone they were using, especially in the form of OxyContin, which was Purdue's patented time-release version of oxycodone, and indeed diversion of those pills into the illicit trade helped fuel the current opiate epidemic. And it's true that the distributors and the drug companies had pushed back at DEA, claiming that the rules DEA was implementing weren't 100% precise. Probably that's right, but probably also they knew relatively well that they were profiting off an epidemic of drug abuse. And the terms of their DEA license said they had a responsibility to act responsibly, and they weren't. Manufacturer OxyContin, for example, spent about $6 billion advertising that drug directly to the consumer. And again, could look at the map and see that there were towns in Kentucky that were getting 100 pills per adult resident.
And that's
clearly not legitimate medical use.
And we're talking about Purdue Pharmacy, right?
Purdue Pharmaceuticals, yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, all of that said, in 2011, I believe, under pressure from DEA and the Food and Drug Administration, Purdue reformulated OxyContin, which, as I say, had been designed as a time-release formulation. But it turned out you could defeat the time-release feature and make all of that drug instantly available with nothing more complicated than a mortar and pestle. So people were doing that, dissolving it and drinking it, or dissolving it and injecting it. And Purdue was encouraged to reformulate it in a way that didn't allow that. So now if you try to break it apart, it just forms a gel that's not soluble. And in fact, you can look and see after they did that reformulation, a dramatic decrease in the number of OxyContin overdoses. So to that extent, the policy was successful. But by the time they got to that point, there were so many people addicted to prescription opiates that dealers in the strictly illegal drugs knew that they would have a market if they moved in. And so rural areas which had never had heroin dealing before in the time of the first and second heroin epidemics suddenly had heroin dealers. And there was a recognizable pattern where either the federal or local cops would come in and shut down a pill mill, an abusive pharmacy, or an abusive medical practice that was massively writing prescriptions. And a couple of weeks later, the dealers would show up. So basically, the prescription drugs created a market for opiates that had not previously existed. But that market's now not dependent on prescription drugs. It can be and is being filled with strictly illicit drugs. And so what you had after 2011 was a decrease in the number of OxyContin or oxycodone deaths, increased the number of heroin deaths. Heroin's now leveled off, and now the new increase in deaths is the fentanyls, a whole class of compounds more potent than heroin. So that's what's going on. This bill passed in 2016. It's not clear, to me at least, that there was any important enforcement activity still left to be done that this bill made impossible. On the other hand, it's pretty clear from the story that the companies had lobbying muscle on the Hill and used that to muscle the DEA, including forcing out the head of their diversion unit. And they're saying now, well, you know, why didn't the administration say something about it? Because Congress writes the laws, and they are in a position where if they didn't accept this thing that was presented as a compromise, they thought they'd be stuck with something worse. And, of course, any administrative agency is under the threat that if the Congress is displeased, it will lose appropriation. So that's what happened. This is a fairly standard application of lobbying muscle with some very heavy players from both parties. Former government officials who were helping the drug companies. And again, not absolutely obvious that they didn't have some sort of a case, but it is absolutely obvious that nobody now wants to take responsibility for what they did.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Kleinman. He's a professor of public policy in the Crime and Justice Program at the Marin Institute on Urban Management at New York University. He is the author of When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, and he edits the Journal of Drug Policy Analysis and also worked for the United States Department of Justice as director of policy management analysis for the criminal division. But the thing that's so obvious, surely, particularly from the DEA's point of view, Mark, is that so often throughout the war on drugs, they went after big drug dealers, so-called kingpins. They went after jungle pharmacies or jungle manufacturing operations deep in the jungles of Colombia, etc. You go after the source. In other words, you go after the manufacturer. Well, here we have Purdue Pharmaceuticals, the manufacturer, and a lot of people are wondering, well, why is it so difficult to stop it if this is being abused? And from what we understand is that the DEA whistleblower, certainly in the 60 Minutes piece, said that this legislation pushed by Marsha Blackburn and Tom Marino did in fact make it harder for the DEA to prevent distributors from shipping pills to these rogue pharmacies and corrupt doctors. So,
but again, that was after Purdue had already
reformulated
its product to the point where it wasn't currently the big problem.
So why did the lobbying happen then? Why lobby if you'd already changed the formula and the pill is no longer useful on the black market?
As I read the story, and I could be wrong about this, but as I read the story, it wasn't Purdue that was doing the pushing. It was the distributors like CVS and Cardinal. The people who get drugs from drug companies and ship them to pharmacies. And they had been under a lot of pressure. And the fact that it was no longer entirely relevant to OxyContin didn't mean that it wasn't a threat to them.
I see.
And so, you know, I mean, look, almost any company would like less regulation rather than more regulation. And this was just, you know, part of that reflex. And, you know, is this going to make it harder to stop the next prescription drug epidemic? Yeah, probably. Unless it's undone, which it probably will be. Purdue, of course, was criminally charged and pleaded guilty to a whole set of charges around the marketing of OxyContin in the mid-2000s. And some of us were very upset that the company pleaded and paid a $600 million fine. And
that's after spending, but that's after spending $6 billion, you said, advertising the drug.
Right. So the company was allowed to plead guilty, you know, was hit with a fine, which it could pay. Three of its executives were actually also convicted or pleaded guilty criminally, but they didn't get any prison time. Some of us thought that the senior people at Purdue could have been charged the way physicians have been charged. Physician who writes a prescription to a patient that the physician knows is going to resell that prescription, which is, you know, a felony under the drug laws, that physician can be charged as an accessory to that crime. And physicians have gone to prison because DEA convinced the judge and jury that they should have known that this patient was diverting. Well, if the standard is should have known, a bunch of those guys could be in orange suits. But it was in the Bush administration, and they hired Rudy Giuliani as their criminal defense lawyer, and he made a deal. So this is not the first piece of legal outrageousness around this epidemic.
Well, but the epidemic, as I mentioned, I've been reading figures that at least 200,000 Americans have died from prescription drug opioids, and it's
I think that's total opioids you're talking about. Prescription plus heroin plus plus the fentanyls.
Right, but the expectation is that in a few years' time, it'll be up to 500,000. And when in the Rose Garden today, when Donald Trump was asked about Tom Marino, he said, "We're going to be looking into Tom Marino. He's a great guy. I did see the report. We're going to look into the report." He also said, Trump, that he would formally declare a national opioid emergency next week.
And it's the same national opioid emergency he said he'd declare 2 months ago.
Right. So you're not expecting anything earth-shattering?
He might actually finally sign the paperwork. You never can tell. But this is not the first time he's announced that he's going to announce an emergency. And the last time, he just didn't bother to follow through. I've got the number here in front of me. It looks like prescription opioids were 183,000 deaths from 1999 to 2015.
Right, but then you have to add the heroin deaths into that.
Right.
Because
heroin, that's on top.
This is the bizarre part, isn't it? That if a drug produced by Big Pharma ended up encouraging heroin use.
Right. My friends in the drug legalization movement would push back at this point and say, no, it wasn't OxyContin that encouraged heroin use. It was the crackdown on OxyContin that encouraged heroin use. In fact, both propositions are correct. When the OxyContin market was still running crazy it was and is pretty expensive on the illicit market. Heroin's much cheaper. And so what happened was that people would get strung out on the prescription drugs, either lose their supplier because the feds cracked down on the pill mill, or simply no longer be able to afford their habit, and then trade down to heroin.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Mark, you mentioned that fentanyl's now emerging as an even bigger problem. I understand a lot of it, if not most of it, is coming from China. It's almost ironic, isn't it? The West brought about the opium wars and enfeebled China, and now China's paying us back. Is that a reasonable supposition?
I'd be a little bit surprised if sending fentanyl here was a piece of Chinese foreign policy, mm-hmm. rather than just, some crooks in China.
Right.
No doubt they have corrupt relationships in the government, but
right.
It is true that we get our fentanyl now, all these molecules, mostly from China. When I first ran into fentanyl as a drug of abuse, it was being domestically manufactured. If we could stop China from making the fentanyls, all we'd do is move the industry someplace else, maybe here. So this is not a problem that we could solve by getting some foreign country to do the right thing.
Well, just in closing, what can we do? What would be the fix here?
You want a quick fix? Something to reduce the number of overdose deaths next year? Raise the tax on alcohol. Most of it, what gets recorded as opiate deaths, are actually combinations with alcohol or the benzos or both. And simply made alcohol a little bit more expensive, people would use a little bit less of it. And if you're not drinking, it's harder to kill yourself. That's a solution that satisfies nobody because it's neither soft nor tough. But it's the only one I've got in my pocket that I'm sure would work immediately. And again, it'll work in the sense of reduce the number of deaths next year. There's no way out of this problem. We're going to have a long, bad run because we've currently got a million or two people addicted to the opiates. And that tends to be a long-lasting problem.
And having Narcan more available, is that useful?
It's helpful. It's helpful. I'm glad that Narcan is now being made available. It's a big change in the attitude of law enforcement toward people with opiate problems, that they're prepared to save those lives. But I do have to, have some feeling for them when they save some guy's life at midnight and again at 4 a.m.
Well, on that note, we'll leave you today, Mark. I thank you for joining us. It's obviously a clear and present social problem in this country. And let's wait to see.
Promise me you'll pick a more pleasant topic next time.
Right, and let's wait to see what President Trump does next week.
Exactly.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Kleinman, who is a professor of public policy in the Crime and Justice Program at the Marin Institute on Urban Management at New York University. He's the author of When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment. And he edits the Journal of Drug Policy Analysis. And he also worked for the U.S. Department of Justice as Director of Policy and Management Analysis for the Criminal Division. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an analysis of the results of the Austrian elections.
Have some more. Oh, the damage done. I hit the city and I lost my band. I watched the needle take another man. Gone, the damage done.
Well, I'm gonna tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists, bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists, bound to lose.
Yes.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Austria is Christian Schuller, who's the senior editor in the magazine and documentary department of the Austrian TV network ORF, where he previously worked as a correspondent in the U.S., Latin America, the Soviet Union, Turkey, and Iran. And currently he's developing a new magazine program called 1-1. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christian Schuller.
Hello.
So, Christian, the elections have alarmed some people in Europe. There's been a sense that the far right has been held off a little with the French elections, for example, and then the elections in the Netherlands. There were certainly gains in the recent German elections by the far right. But in Austria, it's pretty extraordinary how the Freedom Party took 27% of the vote, and the Conservative People's Party, led by the 31-year-old Sebastian Kurz, got 31% of the vote. And the left really took a drubbing, with the Socialist Party dropping to 26%. So the real issue now is, will Kurz choose to throw his lot in with the far right or go back to a coalition with the Socialist Party? So what's your guess on that?
Well, what we expect here, most of the journalists and most of the observers, is that there will be a right-wing coalition between the Christian Democrat Party and the populists, the so-called Freedom Party. This is the most probable result, and it has been expected. Also, the result of these elections had been expected, but it doesn't mean that there's no reason for concern.
Well, the fact that the Freedom Party was founded in the 1950s by former Nazis, it's true that there was a coalition with the far right under Haider in, 2000. But why is this evoking such alarm then?
Well, the alarm is because, first of all, this party is still growing in numbers, even compared to Haider's times, and especially what is more alarming is that the other parties are more and more adopting the Freedom Party's program and political positions. So there's a feeling that this populist party is kind of pushing all the other political actors into the right. And there seems to be no political recipe against them. And that's what is what raises concern. There's no strategy against the populists. There is no, and not even an awareness in the political elite that how dangerous this situation could be for the country.
So are you saying then that the Freedom Party, in effect, pushed Kurz to the right, since when he was Austria's foreign minister, he closed off emigration from the Balkans and his party was behind the banning of Muslim veils in public spaces, etc. Would that be a result of pressure from the right-wing Freedom Party?
Yes. I mean, of course, the situation has several layers. There's a psychological layer also. People in a country like Austria are very much afraid that their high standards of social system, social security, will more and more be eroded and more be undermined by immigration. So that's one main concern in Austria, and the populist party is exploiting this feeling while demanding that those social benefits should be, of course, only reserved for Austrians and denied to migrants and to all kinds of foreigners. While on the other hand, the conservative party, or so-called Christian Democratic Party, anyway wants to reduce social benefits and social costs, and it is just using the opportunity of this discussion. So there's nobody defending the rights of the poor at this moment, and of course the populist party, the Freedom Party, has chosen this subject as its main topic, but on the other hand, there's also another reason for this strength of the populist party, which is in the party system in Austria. We have Austrian politics is dominated by two big parties like United States, but we have this system of this voting system, this election system, that makes it very difficult to have a clear majority. So we always had coalitions among the big two parties. People got tired of this coalition, and all the energy, all the protests all of against this established two-party system is helping the populists. The populists are the voice of all those who are unhappy with the coalition system, and at the same time they are using this very deep sentiment against migrants.
And again, I'm speaking with Christian Schuller. He is a senior editor in the magazine and documentary department of the Austrian TV network ORF, where he previously worked as a correspondent in the US, Latin America, the Soviet Union, Turkey, and Iran. And currently he's developing a new magazine program called 1-1. So in terms of forming coalitions, and I believe you'll know the final results will be in Thursday, is that right? In the next few days?
Yes, Thursday we will have the final results,
right.
But there is almost no doubt about the main result, which is that the Socialist Party will be second, very close with the Freedom Party on the third place, but it's very probable that the Conservative Christian Democratic Party and the Populist Party will form a new government.
Now, is there anything left, though, to work with? You've still got 15% small parties. The Greens did not register that much, did they?
Well, in this case, there was also a very unfortunate situation that there was a split in the Green Party, which made part of them not reach parliament, because we have this 4% barrier.
Right.
And so for this reason, the Greens have been weakened, but also for another reason, this polarization and this strengthening of the Populist Party makes many people choose one of the bigger parties, in this case also the Social Democrats, rather than a small party, because people thought that in this case the Socialists are the only ones who could stop the right.
I see.
Which did not happen.
Well, it hasn't happened, but you're saying it's not likely to happen, right?
And no.
So it wouldn't be like the situation in Sweden, where they isolated the right, but the opposite happened in Norway, where they embraced the right into coalition government. So you don't think that Kurz is going to isolate the Freedom Party, he's going to embrace it?
No, it will be embraced. No. Effectively, there's not so much ideological difference left between those two main parties, which means that the right, the political right, is representing 16% of the Austrian population.
Right.
Which is quite a lot.
Well, but this leader of the Freedom Party, Heinz Christian Strache, he's a pretty incendiary character, isn't he? Didn't the election campaign itself was pretty ugly, wasn't it?
The campaign was ugly, but compared to former campaigns, Mr. Strache, who isn't a teenager anymore, he became also a grey wolf, one could say. So this time he used a little bit more restraint because he felt that the political battle between the two main parties was so ugly and also seen as very ugly by the population that the Freedom Party could just sit and wait how those other parties are kind of hitting each other. But now, once there's the opportunity to get into the government and maybe being the only alternative even for forming a government, they will show their true face. I think they are kind of they want to demand as much posts as they can and as much influence as they can, of course. And we will see how this government will look, whether Mr. Kurz, who has been very successful in this campaign, but whether he will be as successful in managing the negotiations with the Freedom Party. And but the so-called Freedom Party, of course, is a very Austrian phenomenon also in it. Although there are parties like this in other countries, other European countries too. But the special Austrian situation is very much linked with Austria's role during World War II. I mean, it seems strange after 70 years that this is still so much a political factor, but it is, which means that Austria after the Second World War always tried to see itself as a victim of Nazism and not as an actor. And so this was kind of a consensus in Austria that we were not so much responsible for what happened during World War II. But of course, this feeling was not the official position. The official Austria, of course, showed signs of regret and self-criticism. But in the population, there was a large segment of the population that continues to see itself as kind of a victim. And the Freedom Party expressed, and is still expressing this feeling, that it is unfair to see Austria as on a pair with Germany as being responsible for Nazism. And they play on this feeling. So they play both on the modern migration problem, and they play on something that is 70 years or 80 years old.
So will this be revived, this sentiment that you're talking about, Christian Schuller, if the European Parliament in Brussels comes down on the Freedom Party as they did in 2000 against Jörg Haider and Wolfgang Schlissel when he brought the Freedom Party into the government?
Exactly. That's what the Freedom Party is waiting for, I guess. As they are, of course, due to their ideological position, they are very much critical of the European Union, and what they try to provoke is a kind of criticism from Brussels, so that they can show themselves as the only defenders of Austria against the outer world and against Europe.
So that's very similar to what's happening next door in Hungary under Prime Minister Viktor Orban, right? He's championed illiberal democracy, as he calls it, and he's a huge fan of President Vladimir Putin of Russia.
Exactly, and there are more parallels. Some people already compare Mr. Kurz, the new chancellor, as it seems to be, to Mr. Orban, who at the beginning of his political career also was a Democrat and a liberal, but became more and more authoritarian. So far we don't have this in Austria, but the way Mr. Kurz portrayed himself during the campaign and the way he's treating his own party shows that there is this tendency to see politics in a much more authoritarian way. And then there's also another parallel between Hungary and Austria, which is this latent anti-Semitism. Although both countries have very few Jews left after Second World War, but there is this way of indirectly blaming Jews for many things. And in the Austrian campaign, in the electoral campaign, there has been an incident that played very well into this feeling that a scandal was revealed that the Social Democratic Party had prepared a dirty campaigning against Mr. Kurz, and the architect of this dirty campaigning happens to be an Israeli specialist, public relations. So the fact that Mr. Silverstein was the one who was to blame for this dirty campaigning played a big role in this campaign, and made me fear, and not only me but many many other people, that this could also be the beginning of a revival of anti-Semitism.
Well, it's certainly happening. Whether it's solely a revival of anti-Semitism or just a revival of far-right politics, as we mentioned, Hungary, also it's happening in Poland, in Germany. The Alternative for Deutschland party did very well in the last election. And now you've got a situation where you may have a right-wing coalition between conservatives and far-right, a party that has its roots founded by Nazis. Yeah. So what's going on in that broader context? Because one of the aspects that I've never been able to pin down, but it's highly coincidental, that what brought about a lot of this angst in Europe was the massive migration that took place a couple of years ago from Syria. And that massive migration happened just after Russia got involved in Syria and deployed their forces. And the head of NATO at the time accused Vladimir Putin of weaponizing refugees. But it looks as though the Assad government basically gave a lot of the Sunni areas that supported the revolution or the against him, that he gave them the sort of a window to get out before they got killed. And they sort of massively migrated through Turkey into Greece and right into Europe. And the rest is history in terms of creating this Islamophobia. So can you make the case that, as many have tried to make, that a lot of this is ultimately being orchestrated by Putin himself and by Russia?
Well, I mean, it's possible, but I would not say that it plays such a big role in this Austrian situation, as we had this anti-Islamic feeling well before this latest wave of refugees. So, of course, it became this. It's possible that this wave has been manipulated as a political weapon, and if it has, then it works very well because it strengthened those feelings. But in fact, the problem, you could say it for Germany, maybe. Yeah, you could say in Germany, it really changed the atmosphere, the political discussion. In Austria, we already had this strong rightist, populist Freedom Party, even before, years before this sure. wave of migration. So, right. So it's not the result of it.
No, but Germany, it's widely understood that Merkel was the only European leader that sort of really did embrace it, not as a problem or as a disaster, as the way Orban described it, as diluting Christian Europe, but rather she embraced it as a way to revitalize Germany's economy, etc. So she's the exception there, is she not, in terms of a conservative government?
In terms of reaction. In terms of reaction, yes. So Mr. Kurz, who was our foreign minister at that time, mm-hmm. always tried to distance himself from his political sister Angela Merkel in this way. So it's true that Germany, but still, in Germany, I think the impact. I'm not a specialist on Germany, but I think that the AfD got a lot of strength due to this migration, to this refugee problem, while you cannot say the same thing in Austria, because in Austria the Freedom Party would be as strong as it is now, even without this refugee crisis.
Well, Christian Schiller, I thank you very much, and we should stay in touch, obviously. We'll know more on Thursday, but it looks as though the outlines are pretty clear at this moment, and you seem to be pretty sure that it's going to be a right-wing coalition.
Yeah, I think that anything else would be a big surprise, because for the Social Democratic Party to go into a coalition with the Freedom Party is theoretically possible. There are some figures in the Socialist Party who would prefer this to the role of opposition, but it would be such a challenge for the party, because there's a very very strong very anti fascist wing inside the Social Democratic Party, who would not swallow this coalition so easily. So I think for this to happen, it would take months and months of discussions, while a coalition between the Conservative Party and the Freedom Party is a matter of a few weeks, I think.
Well, Christian Schiller, again, I thank you very much for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Christian Schiller, who is the senior editor in the magazine and documentary department of the Austrian TV network, ORF, where he previously worked as a correspondent in the US, Latin America, the Soviet Union, Turkey, and Iran, and currently he's developing a new magazine program called 1-1. We're going to take a restation break and back examining the fate of the Kurds in northern Iraq after the government in Baghdad just seized oil-rich Kirkuk. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored and co-authored and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. And he has an article at the American Interest, How to Manage Post-Democracy Turkey. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And it looks as though the Iraqi army caught the Kurdistan Regional Government in the north by surprise when they and they basically invaded and entered central Kirkuk. And Kirkuk, of course, is an important city, a hub of a major oil installation, which has in many ways been the cash cow for the Kurdish regional government. So did the Kurds get caught by surprise? After all, they had that referendum recently, which was very provocative.
Yes, I mean, they were really caught by surprise. They didn't expect the Iraqi army to move in and risk a major confrontation. And so, yes, it looks like the referendum really backfired on them. And I think this is a major setback for Barzani, the leader of the Kurds, and also for the unity of the Kurdish region, because there are now very serious tensions between the two factions that existed within Kurdistan. I mean, there's Mr. Barzani's faction, which probably is two-thirds of the country, and then one-third of the country is another group whose leader died recently, actually. So yes, I mean, this is a major, major setback, and it's not clear how they will manage this in the short run. And as you said, it is the cash cow of the Kurdish region, because the Kirkuk region has all the oil. Now, the other thing is to remember is that the Iraqi army in 2014 was on the outskirts of Kirkuk, controlled part of the region, not the city itself. The city was run by the Kurds, but there was kind of a modus vivendi between the Iraqi military and the Kurds. And the Kurds governed, but the Iraqi military was there. But when ISIS emerged, the Iraqi military ran away. And when they did, it created a vacuum, which with time the Iraqi Kurds filled. So the change that we see is partially a reversion back to the status quo ante, but also partially now the Iraqi government has taken over territory and positions that were controlled by the Kurds. So it's a very complicated situation, and we'll see how it works out.
And again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. And he has an article at The American Interest, How to Manage Post-Democracy Turkey. So you mentioned the role of Iran. I understand in many ways, it's the Quds force that's been pressuring the Baghdad government into this offensive, and they took a part in at least at strategic level, and I'm not sure about whether they were in hands-on in terms of the invasion or the capture of Kirkuk. But it's as though the Kurds are in an impossible situation, surely, because Turkey is also equally hostile towards them, as is Iran, and now the Baghdad government of Iraq.
Yes, the Kurds are being squeezed from three different directions. I think they did not anticipate the kind of reaction they would get from the referendum. I mean, I think had they known that the referendum results would have led to these results, they would not have done it. But of course, you can't deal with hindsight. That said, one has to be also a little bit careful in terms of talking about the Iranian role. I mean, I think the Iranians were influential in pushing the government, but the Iranian role is a little bit complicated in the following sense. There are elections coming up in Iraq next April. We don't know the date, but approximately in April. And Mr. Abadi, who's the incumbent prime minister, who actually is a moderate, and even though he ordered this onslaught today, but he was being challenged by his predecessor, Mr. Maliki, who's actually far more extreme than him in terms of sectarian politics in Iraq, is seen as much more divisive figure, whereas Mr. Abadi has tried to patch divisions in Iraq. But he could not have stayed idle after the referendum. And this is where I think the Iraqi Kurds misplayed their hand, because they didn't realize that Abadi was going to be forced into action, because if he doesn't, then his opponents will have the upper hand, and maybe the Iranians would have encouraged his opponents, because Abadi is seen as pro-American, and so the Iranians would be very happy to see him go, especially in the new context of increased Iranian-American tensions. So, you know, this is a multifaceted game. Now, one of the consequences of this could be that if there was any hope of reconfiguring Iraq in such a way, maybe create a confederation instead of federation, and keeping the Kurds in, maybe that's dead. I mean, look, this is the first day, the first 24 hours. I think it's would be very foolish to speculate. But there are different possibilities ahead. One is that the Kurds may say, look, we were right in having our referendum. Clearly, the Iraqi government has no respect for us, etc. That's one possibility. The other possibility that we haven't really thought about and needs to be considered is that Iraqi Kurdistan is home to more than 2 million, I think, or close to 2 million refugees, Iraqi refugees, Sunnis, who escaped the war and who are living essentially in Iraqi Kurdistan. What will they do? Right? They are not pro-Baghdad. They are not sympathetic to the Baghdad regime. Are we creating now is a new division going to emerge down the road between the Iraqi Sunnis and the Iraqi Kurds against the majority Shia? And that's potentially a very dangerous development. I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm just throwing these ideas out there. As I said, it's too early to speculate, but we can think of potentials out there. Plus, if you cut off funds to the Iraqi Kurdish government, who's going to feed those refugees? I mean, because it's the Iraqi, in some ways, not completely, but the Iraqi government, Kurdish government, was helping them out. So there are many different consequences that have yet to be worked out. And we'll see how they play themselves out in the next few days. Of course, the other big unknown here is Washington. I mean, President Trump apparently said that we're not taking sides in this. Well, that's one way of putting it. But in reality, it is true that American officials have tried to find ways to delay the referendum, to come up with solutions. They didn't succeed. But we are dealing with essentially State Department that is very weak at the moment, that has a huge series of portfolios he has to deal with, a president who is not really involved in these issues and just reacts. So I think it will be also incumbent on the U.S. government now to kind of sit down and think, okay, so where is this going to go? What is it that we want to achieve? And find a modicum of an understanding that will not ultimately make things worse for the people living there and, of course, for the United States. Because in the end, Iran is the neighbor of Iraq and a neighbor of the Kurds. Right? Iran is the one country that presumably Mr. Trump really doesn't like and thinks is has to be contained, has to be, you know, the nuclear deal should be kicked out. But on the other hand, to hand Iraq and Kurdistan to the Iranians so easily, the same week when he essentially, in a dramatic way, put an end to or tried to put an end to the Iranian nuclear deal with the United States and the allies. Now, Iran has the upper hand, a real upper hand in Iraq, and maybe the Kurds will turn to Iran to be the intermediary. One faction of the Iraqi Kurds is already close to Iran, the PUK, and so. You know, here, the Kurds lose, Abadi wins, United States loses, but the Iranians win.
Right.
And if the Iranians win, the Syrians win. I mean...
Well, it does seem, though, that the U.S., of course, owes a kind of debt, if you will, to the Kurds in terms of the Peshmerga being the only boots on the ground that have fought with the U.S. against the Islamic State. And likewise, it's true in Syria. Against Raqqa, for example, it's obviously infuriated Turkey under Erdogan. But
those are different Kurds. Remember?
Of course,
those
they are
Syrian
yeah.
Kurds, right? And not Iraqi Kurds.
Sure, but
and the plane shall not necessarily meet in any time soon.
No, but Donald Trump did say today that we're not taking sides, and we don't like the fact that they're clashing. But as you mentioned, the U.S. did try to restrain the Kurds and try to come up with a better formula, working with Baghdad on to delay a referendum, and the Kurds didn't listen. But what leverage does the U.S. have? I mean, when we refer to Iraq as our ally, but it's largely dominated by Iran. And when you say that the Kurds could make, at least the Talibani faction, the PUK, could make a deal with, want to make a deal with Iran. Of course, they were sold out, were they not, years ago under Kissinger and the Shah. So,
Everybody has sold the Kurds down the road. I mean, yeah. It's not just 1975, the event you're referring to, but they've been sold out before. But look, the big issue here is, and again, this is Monday morning quarterbacking. If Mr. Trump had just picked up the phone and told Mr. Barzani, look, I have a plan. I want you to postpone the referendum. This is what, you know, we will promise, and you have my word. Right? As much as that's worth something. But that may have done something. But, you know, we have a president who's not that involved in the details of foreign policy, because for the most part I don't think he really understands them. But also, I think the Iraqi Kurds were not going to be persuaded by Mr. Tillerson. Right? When all you read about Tillerson is that he's about to leave, he's about to be fired, he doesn't really have the president's ear.
He's being castrated.
So,
he's being castrated.
Well, yeah, that's right. And so I think... An engagement, but again, this is Monday morning quarterbacking, but an engagement by the president may have made a difference. And look, the other message here that people will be looking at, the other recipient of the message today are the Syrian Kurds, because the Syrian Kurds have put now all their eggs in the American basket. And we have wanted them to essentially break their relations with the regime in Damascus and completely side against both Damascus and ISIS. And that will, you know, the Syrian Kurds are going to look at this and they're going to say, maybe we should maintain our relations with the regime in Damascus. Maybe we should think about making a deal after the Iraq cooperation is over. Right? And in fact, you know, they've been a little bit reluctant to also fight the regime. They don't want to fight the regime. They've already suffered severe casualties with ISIS, so why lose more people? I mean, that's one. It's a small population. But I think what the lack of, the perceived lack of American engagement, and again, I mean, I know the Americans tried very hard, and I'm not trying to essentially dump on the United States, but maybe had we engage at a higher level, maybe if we don't say today what we're saying. Now, you have to understand that the administration here has an incentive to side with Abadi because Abadi is seen here as a person who is not pro-Iranian in Baghdad, that he wants to be independent of the Iranians. So we can't, it's a very delicate game Washington has to play because while you're trying to protect the Kurds, you don't want to alienate Abadi, you don't want to push Abadi completely into the hands of the Iranians, because Abadi has a very difficult job in Baghdad because he has all these militias that he doesn't control, right? He has an army that he's not always sure whether he can rely on it or not. And so he has to come out of this as a victor. And it is possible that the one outcome of today's events is that Abadi's stature will be enhanced, and therefore his writ over Baghdad will be stronger, and therefore he might be able to resist the Iranians a great deal more because he's shown that he's independent, that he knows how to take tough decisions, and so on and so forth. So there is a positive, if you want, story from Mr. Abadi's perspective, and to the extent that we want Mr. Abadi to be stronger, so it does work to Washington's advantage. But in the end, unfortunately, if all these things had not happened, it would have been best. It would have been the best outcome for us. Now we're essentially left picking not crumbs, but you know, the second best solutions out of a crisis situation, and the second best, by definition, may not be. I mean, there are gradations of second best, right? So I don't know how good of a second best this is, and we have to sit and wait and see how this develops. I mean, there may be many more surprises that we can't anticipate at this stage.
Well, Henri Bakke, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Henri Bakke, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored and co-authored and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and he has an article at the American Interest, How to Manage Post-Democracy Turkey. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.